Just as a note, this was originally recorded as both audio and video. Unfortunately, due to internet connectivities on my end, the audio and video did not synchronize correctly, resulting in my audio sounding a bit rough as I was having to use a phone to record. This is through no fault of Ray's. I apologize for the inconvenience. To ensure that everyone can enjoy the content, I have enhanced the audio to an acceptable quality.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest edition of the Ascension live stream podcast, etc., whatever we end up calling it. We don't really have a cool name for it yet. As with all things related to OSINT intelligence, we don't really worry about the titles. We just worry about the content. Today, I would like to introduce our guest, Ray Bango. Ray is a cloud advocate at Microsoft, focused on being a voice for students, rising developers, technology practitioners, and security researchers within Microsoft. How's it going, Ray?
It's going great. It's been a whirlwind week, and I'm just really grateful to be on the show. It's been a while since I've been it's been a while since I've had any real conversations about security. And so this is really cool. I'm glad to be having this moment to chat with you. So thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. You're definitely one of the people that I look up to in industry. So I'm going to stop the share so that we literally, our faces, sorry to ruin everyone's day. Just because, you know, I have my standard joke of I have a face made for radio. Yeah, so we've been talking back and forth the past few days about some OSINT stuff that we won't really get into. You know, I know that you're really interested in the offensive side and how OSINT meshes with that. So kind of give us an idea of how you see OSINT operating in a perfect scenario for this.
Oh, wow. That's a hard question, but I will give it a shot. And so if you think about offensive security and you think about the end goals, which is really trying to identify what's the security posture of a company, how do you minimize some of the risks? I think what ends up happening is folks forget that really having a broader view of where the information lies for a specific company plays a big part in how threat actors actually assess their entry points, their ingress points into a company. And so, you know, I remember reading Joe Vest's book and on red teaming, and that's one of the key things that any threat actor is going to do. They're going to do homework on a company. They're going to do their OSINT work. They're going to investigate. They're going to use every resource available. And this is why it was funny, because in my tweet, I put the very scary Joe Gray, because I know that during our conversations, some of the things that you said, I'm like, man, how did he know that? And it was funny. I hit you up on, I think it was on DM or on the phone. You said, oh, you're an iPhone user. And I was like, yep, I knew it. As soon as I sent it out, I was like, he's going to know I'm an iPhone user. And sure enough. And the reason that this is important is because those are how you start defining your attack vectors. This is how you define your pathways into making inroads into a company. And whether you're doing a phishing attack or whether you're doing trying to identify some vulnerable system that's out there, doing the homework ahead of time is a critical thing. I was listening to the Darknet Diary podcast again, and I like to go back to some of the older episodes. And there was one that's called something about Adventures of an APT Threat Actor. And they were actually going through the attack kill chain. And it was interesting because I think it was on the third stage, which is, it's the reconnaissance stage. It's basically really advanced OSINT. What are they doing? They're trying to identify key people within the organization to be able to get to that leverage point and be able to pull those levers to be able to get into, to get the proper level of access that they need to accomplish whatever their end goal is. That's all OSINT. I think we forget the importance of doing our homework, that legwork to be able to get us into the door. And then how do we move? How do we move within a network or an organization once we're in? That's still more OSINT. Recon is OSINT. Recon is doing your homework and your legwork and getting in there. So yeah, that's kind of how I see that.
I totally agree with you there. And it's funny you should mention Joe Vest, because he's actually commenting in the Twitch chat now. Oh. Joe Vest being someone that I also look up to. Joe Vest being one of the people who, in the early days of the old podcast, the Advanced Persistent Security podcast, I had him and James Tuberville on the show to talk about red teaming, and it somehow or another we got sidetracked into OSINT. What a big surprise. But you You really hit the nail on the head in terms of with how we can use OSINT. One particular differentiation that I would want to throw out there with regards to the relationship between OSINT and reconnaissance, proper OSINT is purely passive.
True.
People who have been watching the streams or the YouTube videos or listening to the podcast in its new form are probably familiar with the line of conversation I'm about to state. And I had a disagreement with the previous manager because we were doing an OSINT investigation into a company for a merger and acquisition. I'll just leave it right there. And he's like, so when are you guys going to run Nmap? We're like, we're the OSINT team. We don't run Nmap. He's like, but it's reconnaissance. And I was the senior person on the team. So I was like, that's not within our scope. And he's like, well, it is now. Being the senior, we had a spirited discussion. I'll leave it that way. And we discussed whether it was really active or passive. And he agreed that ultimately I won the argument, but I lost the argument because we still ran Nmap. It was built into the contract. That's the part that he never told us the complete story about anything. And that's the part of the story he never told us. That being said, though, if you're able to find someone else's Nmap scans, now that's purely admissible in my opinion. And I've got some pretty clever Google dorks to search for Nmap scans. It's like, hey, look for this. Because, for example, if someone runs an Nmap scan with the hyphen lower O upper A operator, what will ultimately happen is that will save the scan results in XML, Nmap, and grepable Nmap, GNMap format. As people start to put things in AWS, Azure, DigitalOcean, Dropbox, etc., and they don't access control it, and then Google spiders it, well, ahoy there, my friend. I just got scan results. I just effectively ran Nmap without having to run Nmap. The target has almost zero opportunity for detecting me, unless, of course, the target's Google, and Google already knows everything, so it's okay. I see it as a very powerful offensive tool, and I also see it as a very powerful defensive tool. Something that I'm a staunch advocate of on the defensive side is attack surface monitoring. If security teams are not using OSINT like the adversaries to enumerate their architecture, to enumerate what is going on out there so that we know, hey, what's out there? And it should be more than just Shodan, everyone's favorite asset inventory system. Shodan has a lot of good stuff, but at the same time, it's very different at times. And Shodan gets blocked pretty easily from some more advanced organizations. But if you start factoring in my personal favorite, and this is my personal favorite when investigating businesses, or if I'm looking to do pen test or red team reconnaissance augmentation, DNS. If Shakira worked in InfoSec, DNS would be her hips, because DNS does not lie. It is a sole source of truth. And you have so many opportunities for subdomain enumeration. You're not having to run sublister, which, oh, you guessed it, it's another opportunity for detection. You are able to look at history. You're able to look at vendor relationships. If you're trying to do social engineering, which, you know, shameless plug, I wrote a book about social engineering. So if you're looking to do social engineering and you're going to do something with trying to get someone to, say, open a document that they think is that requires their signature, if they use DocuSign, there's a DNS text record for that. It really gives you so many keys to the kingdom. And a term that I used very heavily in the book is context for the contact. It gives an adversary a better lay of the land to understand what is actually going on. You don't have to worry about burning a Microsoft exploit on an organization that is remote first, primarily operating in the cloud, not even using Active Directory, and they issue Macs or Linux workstations to all their employees, and they might have a Windows footprint of, say, four systems.
Yeah,
that saves you a lot of opportunity for detection.
Using these systems, it's incredible. And I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm already like taking mental notes because I'm learning a lot of stuff, which is fantastic. This is one of the reasons I love speaking with people about their different techniques. When you were talking, I was thinking about dhash, for example. And it was interesting because I used dhash. I remember I used it on a pen test, and I had used it not so much because I actually expected to get something out of that. I had hope, hey, there's some creds. But really, it was more because I was looking at this company, and I found this endpoint, and I'm like, all right, then I wonder if I could find some kind of credentials that I can actually leverage here. From there, I went to LinkedIn, and I looked for specific people that that would be fall into the IT category, whether they're a VP of engineering or whatever. And then from there, I Googled for their email format, and I just kind of pasted it together and then went into Dhash and I said, let me just see if this email works. And sure enough, this email came up and I was like, God, there's so much information out there that can at least give you the starting point to start making some of these decisions that you need to make in order to go from point A to point Z. And it really is interesting how we tend to forget all these different subsystems that we can capitalize to build a picture and a portfolio of a potential attack target. And it's the same when you're doing an OSINT investigation, I'm assuming. And that's one thing I've never done. I've never done an OSINT investigation, but I'm assuming that you go through this process because you're trying to build this portfolio of who it is that you're going after. Who are you trying to glean that information about? And what does this person actually look like? And what's their persona? So I can imagine all the resources that you have at your disposal.
It's almost like you're stalking me or something, because Dhash is definitely on the list of some of my favorite utilities to use. You bring up a use case that I hadn't thought of. It is a very interesting use case in that with Dhash, you can search via a variety of operators. It's not just email address. Mm-hmm. You can search by IP address. You can search by username. You can search by all these things. It's one of those cases where the next time I actually use Dhash in an investigation or I'm helping someone with their pen test reconnaissance, I might just have to get their IP range and drop that in Dhashed, because like some of the use cases I've had for Dhashed in the past, if I find a password that looks rather unique, that's not in like rocku or john.txt, I will drop that in there and I will see if there are other email addresses using the same password. And then the same thing, what other users are in breaches based on that IP address. So there's a lot of moving parts that you have with Dhashed, and actually quite pretty from that perspective. That's definitely pretty solid use case with it. And Dhashed, if you're an OSINT practitioner on a budget and you're doing more than just TraceLabs events, because I'm not going to say that Dhashed is explicitly allowed or disallowed from TraceLabs events. That's a little bit of murky water. In the AMA, Baloof said it is admissible, but there are other extenuating circumstances that have to be included with that. If you're doing more than just, say, a TraceLabs event, you should probably be looking at Dhashed. And in terms of tooling, it's one of the cheaper resources to gain access to. You can gain 7 days of access for $5.50. You can get a month for $15. And then API requests, it's like $2.50 per 100 if you prefer to script things out yourself. It's definitely on the lower cost of tooling. And that's one of the main reasons I like it, because I don't operate with a massive budget. Like if I'm freelance investigating, I'm doing it almost off of a shoestring budget.
Here's the scenario for you. I just started thinking about this. Let's say, yeah, and I know you have an offensive security background as well. So that's one of the benefits of being able to talk to you, Jay. So Joe, let's think about that. Let's say, you know, if you're an offensive security operator and you're going through the process of trying to identify your target and you want to collect all this information, what are some of the low hanging fruit opportunities that you see without revealing, obviously, your secret sauce? Because I know there's certain things that you want to keep very close to the vest because they help you in your own, you know, investigations. But I'm sure there's some resources that you can share with the folks that are watching the stream that you can say, hey, if you're an offensive operator and you're trying to paint this picture of a target, these are some of the resources that you should explore. And this is how you would chain them together to be able to get this picture of a person you're going after.
Dhashed and Have I Been Pwned, first and foremost. Have I Been Pwned, if you decide to use their API, that's $3.50 a month. Dhashed, It can be between $5 and $15, depending on the duration of your subscription. I also use the Security Researchers Toolkit with Security Trails, which is, I think, $100 a month. That gives you DNS information. It enumerates subdomains. And also with that, it gives you historic DNS information. So you can see when they messed up their SPF record. You can see who their filtering providers are, whether it's Proofpoint, Mimecast, or Outlook. You can see all of that. From there, you can also leverage ViewDNS, which is free, viewdns.info. And to that end, there's a lot of really good data there. It also has a built-in port scanner. It only looks for the most common ports, but it's not attributing to your IP address. So I'm not the ultimate authority on OSINT, but if I were, I would allow it. Another one that I'm a big fan of is DNS Dumpster. It's showing you the same stuff that you see by Security Trails and ViewDNS, but it shows you in a graphical format, and it's also free. From there, if I'm looking at a business, I tend to dive right into social media. Not necessarily directly. For example, if I were looking at Walmart, I'm not going to necessarily look at what Home Office is posting, because Home Office, they have trained PR professionals that have security right behind them that's basically going to say, hey, don't do this, or hey, you should do this, whatever. I'm going to look at it at the store level, so regionally. And then another thing that I will do is I will get their address. I will go on to Snapchat map, map.snapchat.com. It's the Snap map. I will go there and I will look and see if anyone's Snapchatting in the office. I will see what I can snipe from that. And then I do the same exact thing on Instagram. I will go put in their address and I will see what people are posting to Instagram. And then, of course, the comment section is always gold, always. But so those location tools, that's where it's at.
That's an interesting point, because I hadn't thought about Snapchat and Instagram. And so you bring this up, and have you found like really good bits of interesting information that somebody could leverage in an offensive operation? I mean, I'm assuming like if you're doing physical pen testing, totally makes sense. People post badges all the time and you can replicate badges and things like that. But I am always so fearful about posting any picture, and I always look around and make sure I don't have a password, or like even my screen back here is blurred. And I'm sure somebody's already figured out how to remove the blur and stuff like that. But I have to assume people sometimes don't go to the same level of care that we would on some of these pictures.
To that end, I found some pretty juicy stuff. I didn't do any testing to confirm that it was a password. Mm-hmm. On a scale from 1 to 10, I would rate it probably an 80% chance, so an 8, that it's probably a password. I could have went to Dhashed and probably confirmed that, but I didn't. That's one. There's a picture with a particular company. I use it in a demonstration when I teach the intelligence investigations business course. Very briefly, as a shameless plug, if this stuff interests you, I'm teaching that course on April 1st from noon until 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. But anyway, there's a demo. I don't own the organization. I'm not affiliated with the organization. I go to Instagram. I do the search, and we come up on a desk, and there's nothing at the desk. There's no computers or anything there, but we're able to find out so much information about the person who's there, their gender, the office setting itself, what kind of system is in use, all because of the dongles. Okay. And then they had a fan on their desk, and then they had their flare. If you want to think back to that particular movie, they had all the flare on their cubicle that we were able to identify things. This harkens back to the presentation that I was giving circa 2017, where I was just showing people's family stickers on their back windshields and being like, tell me everything you can figure out about this family. Realistically, that's all it really takes. Of course, from the physical side, you can see things like exits. You can look for access control points, cameras to monitor for CCTV, that kind of stuff. And then, of course, you can also look for like who their dumpster company is. So you can roll up and say, I work for such and such. I need to inspect this. And then you steal like 2 or 3 bags of trash, take it back to the office, pay some interns or some broke college students to go through it for you, something like that. That's probably some of the most interesting stuff. I can't think of anything that's really significantly juicier right off the top of my head, but that's definitely a very powerful angle that one could take with using Instagram for OSINT. With Snapchat, I haven't really gotten as close. With Snapchat, I've typically encountered that more when investigating people, which I go into investigating people and investigating businesses entirely different. For one, I refer to businesses as targets. I refer to people as subjects, just because it makes me feel a lot less slimy to call a person a subject. And it's also the same terminology that Trace Labs uses. But with a person, I identified their adult children's Snapchat account. I found them checking in here, checking in there. I got like their dog's name out of it, which I would have gotten that. There were about six other ways I could have gotten that. I got so much information from that perspective. It spoke to their financial status, what they like, any affiliations they have, who they are friends with, and all of that fun stuff.
Well, let's touch on that, because this is actually posing an interesting question, that all this stuff that we, that you and I do, that we've learned, what was it? As Liam Neeson said, I have a special set of skills that I've developed over a very long career. And I was thinking about Warlord Sam07's message about how do they get started? It also poses an interesting question. How long did it take you to get to this point in your career where you have a better understanding of some of these nuances? Because yeah, like if I look at a desk, I can't tell you that I'm going to think about what type of USB ports are they using? What type of, if I see something sitting around, is that useful to me? Especially from an OSINT perspective, because I am being the OSINT newbie, but you've done this a long time. So there's things that I feel from when I'm listening to this conversation that are really critical to your success in identifying and framing your subject or your target. So how did you get to that point where you said this bit of information is so critical?
Honestly, I've been doing OSINT for about 20 years. And with that being said, I didn't know it was called OSINT until about 7 years ago when I had Justin Seitz on my podcast, thinking we were going to be talking about Python. And he started talking about all the stuff he was doing with Imaga and Infoga and all these other tools and how he was identifying pictures of AK-47s using computer vision and all of this stuff. And he kept saying OSINT. I was like, you keep saying that word. What are you referring to? And once he explained it, it all made sense. And harkening back to high school, I was the shy person. You wouldn't know that now because I don't meet strangers anymore. But in high school, I was shy. Even my best friends, if I didn't know their phone number, I was too shy to say, hey, man, can I get your phone number so I can give you a call and maybe we can hang out this weekend or something, play like the new GoldenEye game or something? No, I would be the creepy dude that figured out my friend's dad's name, look him up in the phone book, and then cold call. So realistically, it's OSINT and social engineering pre-internet prevalence days. Admittedly, it is creepy, but that's kind of how I got started. Moving forward into the evolution, once I learned what OSINT was, it's one of those things that, okay, I'm good at this. I'm naturally nosy. I think of things differently. I'm definitely ADHD, non-medicated at this time. I just frame things in a certain way. Honestly, competing in the Trace Labs events, that really got my head wrapped around what questions should I be asking? And then doing things like other CTFs, looking at things that are associated with GeoGuessr and other geolocation things. And then honestly, I kind of got thrust heavily into OSINT in social engineering. My origin story for social engineering is I was working on a PhD. I never finished it. I was working on a PhD. I was doing my literature review for dissertation, and it was around 2016. You need to find something relevant to your discipline that is a major problem. At the time, Locky was running wild, brother. It was running wild on everybody. Locky mania was out there. And how did that work? It sent phishing emails via exploit kits. I couldn't find anything scholarly about ransomware. I found something scholarly about social engineering. And then here's phishing. Now here's social engineering. Social engineering is the marriage of technology, psychology, and sociology. Hey, advisor, if I do something on the topic of social engineering, can I use the psychology and sociology journals? And the answer was yes. I started studying very heavily into social engineering. Of course, the seminal non-academic works, I've read those as well. But then I started realizing, hey, if you have some level of familiarity with someone, that context for the context, if I can give you a reason to talk to me, then I hold all of the power and I can ask those invasive questions. I can get you to tell me the things you should not be telling me. I can get you to tell me an example of your current or previous passwords. For example, Ray, what was your mom's name before she was married?
I don't know. What is it, Jeff? I know exactly where you're going.
Don't make me find out.
I know exactly where you're going. Yeah.
With intelligence, whether it be human intelligence, which would be social engineering, or open source intelligence, OSINT, a lot of it is not what you ask, but it's how you ask it. When you get into the habit of asking questions a particular way or framing your thoughts as it relates to things like this a particular way, it becomes second nature. For example, I had my little one, we'll just say Junior, in line to have pictures made with Santa. There was a family in front of Junior and me at the Santa photo place. I already got weird vibes off the guy anyway. And I was like, oh, this dude's kind of, he kept on harping on his daughter because she didn't wear a necklace that somebody gave her. He brought his own grooming bag and was combing their hair and all of this stuff in line. He was complaining about this, complaining about that. Honestly, he gave me very less than endearing Danny Tanner vibes.
Okay.
Anyway, when he got to the front of the line, they said, hey, we're going to text you a link to be able to view and download and purchase your pictures. We need a phone number. Well, who's doing their Hulk Hogan over here? I'm listening. I take note of the phone number. And I just see how rude he was. They had a huge sign saying no personal photography. They had to replace the printer paper. So Santa got up and was walking around and he pulled his phone out and put it in Santa's face. And Santa told him, hey, you can't do that. And he's like, oh, you mean this? And he kept on filming. It was just totally rude. I was like, all right, less than savory person. So what happens? I end up searching the phone number and he is a realtor. I still have his website pulled up in my phone. I've potentially created some alias accounts by the name of St. Nicholas, Chris Kringle, S. Claus, all of those. And I'm just letting them age before the bad reviews come. Because yeah. I overheard him verbally eviscerating the staff. Sure. And he was complaining because in the picture, his eyes were shut, but he was complaining about it like it was their fault. And he's like, well, fine, just give me the cheapest package and I'll have my team Photoshop. You're dealing with like a mall Santa. Come on, dude.
Exactly. It's interesting on human nature. I mean, everything you're telling me right now, it really revolves around human nature. And you're right. I think all of us have been guilty at some point of just forgetting that there are people within earshot that, and we share a lot of information. But, and some of that is even based on trust. And it was interesting. I had met this person at an event, didn't know the person, but we were talking a little bit about this specific thing, human nature and how trusting people are. And they were like, oh, you can never get my passcode. And I said, oh, I'm sure I couldn't, but you know, I'm not really trying, but oh, hey, wait a minute. You know what? I do need to make a phone call. Can I borrow your phone for a second? And they handed me the phone. I said, oh, what's your passcode? And they gave me the passcode. And then it dawned on them what they had just done. I looked at them and I'm like, and I just smirked. And I said, this is what I'm talking about when it comes to human nature. We're all very trusting people. We try to believe that people will always lead with good intention. And I think a lot of people will lead with good intention, but you're always going to have a group of people that won't. And this is an example of how it's so easy with the wrong person to just make an assumption because people are charismatic. For example, I've been a developer advocate and a security advocate. My role is to engage people directly. I have to have the ability to have conversations to try to connect with them in some fashion. Yeah, I'm sure those skills can translate into something that could be a little bit more malevolent. If I really wanted to, maybe I'd be good at social engineering. Maybe I should do SD Village this coming DEF CON and give it a shot. But the point is that there are people who explicitly will develop skills and leverage those skills for something that's not going to be that great. And you have to be cautious. I think in the OSINT world, having these skills is really beneficial to the work that has to be done to help others reach a certain goal. In your case, for example, I know that in your business, you're helping a lot of folks solve some very complex issues that could be anything from personal attacks to businesses who are just trying to do a regular background. It runs the gamut. And thankfully, people like you have this good intent that I was talking about. You're able to use your skills for good versus wreaking havoc in the world. And I'm sure you've seen some of the darker side of this world too.
Absolutely. And if you want to compete in the SE community at DEF CON, might I recommend my training guide, Practical Social Engineering?
Love it.
Shameless promotion there. I had to do it. You set it up. I can't avoid this.
There you go.
But there's a lot to it. If you want to get better at social engineering, here are the things you need to do. You need to talk to criminals. You need to also, magicians are good to talk to. Illusionists, they are good to sit under the learning tree, so to speak, with. Other groups that would be worthwhile, obviously, psychologists and people in that. Street hustlers, bartenders. Honestly, this may come out a little bit, it's not going to be NSFW, but strippers and sex workers, because they have to rapidly read people. My late dad, he and I are very similar, but yet very different. We're very different because of the sides of the law that we operate on. He had a lot of undiagnosed mental health conditions and basically used drugs to try and make sense of the world. And with that, that got him in some trouble, and he a rather shady character. I can be a rather shady character if I need to be, especially from an OPSEC perspective. At the same time, we also, anytime I would opt myself out of something from a data broker, I would opt him out as well, because similarities in the names. So that's something that we operated off of. He had that street smarts and the ability to talk to people. He didn't, if he wanted something from someone, he didn't meet a stranger. I typically don't meet a stranger. I will talk to a brick wall if it will talk back. Also, you can look at some of the charismatics like Tony Robbins, even some of the prosperity preachers like Joel Osteen. That's another good example of that kind of mentality. We got a couple of questions in the Twitch chat that I think we should probably get to as well, just to make sure that we address them in a timely manner. What are some different career paths a beginner could take in the field of OSINT? I'll let you start, and then I'll follow you up on that one, Ray.
Yeah, sure. So obviously, from the offensive security side, we've kind of identified that there is a definite need to build a persona of your target. I don't even want to say subject, because I know that in most red team assessments, for example, they're really going after a company to try to assess their security posture and also determine how their defensive team reacts to certain circumstances. But unless you're doing an assumed breach type of scenario, if you're going in there black box, you really need to paint that picture. And especially if phishing is allowed, you want to make sure that you can cater your information to a specific way of speaking, something that's normal within the organization that you are actually going after. So I can see that as being in itself an operator position. I can see how somebody who has that skill could be very valuable to a team that's looking to do an assessment. And of course, I mean, I think about some of the folks that like yourself and Michael Bazell and these people who actually go out there and have to do research on different organizations for a variety of different reasons, whether it's, I don't know, doing criminal investigations or in some cases just doing private work to ensure that whatever business relationship you're establishing is going to be something that's successful and mutually beneficial, and that you're not getting into cahoots with somebody that may not be your best interest in mind. So that's kind of the way I look at it. And then also just from a personal level, being able to leverage OSINT skills just on your own to see what's being said about you, what information is being shared out there openly. That's a really interesting skill to have. It's definitely valuable. And if you're able to take it past just a normal Google search and dig into things like DNS, like you mentioned, Joe, and some other tools, that's incredibly beneficial as well.
I wholeheartedly agree with you there. And I'll provide a little bit of a defensive perspective with this as well. If you're trying to get into threat intelligence, you might not be able to immediately jump into threat intel as a noob, but if you're working level one, level two SOC, and you have some OSINT chops and you can start to attempt some attribution associated with things, or start to build some TTPs, build things out with MITRE ATT&CK, with the kill chain, or looking at the pyramid of pain, these things, once you better understand them, it's so much easier. In terms of career paths, to summarize, all these starting out would be kind of a junior position. It may be like a level one or level two SOC analyst, a junior pen tester. You could also potentially work in sales, for that matter, to be honest, because salespeople, they don't meet strangers either. A lot of the people you see hanging out in the SE community, or back in the day, the SE village, they were salespeople. Some of the people who have previously won the SCCTF are salespeople. That's another side you can go with. You don't get to push buttons and fish people. Well, you kind of do get to try to fish people, but different kind of fishing, different intended outcome. That's one perspective. You could always go down the private investigator route. Depending on which state you are in or which country you're in the United States, 41 states require private investigator licenses. And of the nine that don't, there are certain counties, cities, townships, et cetera, that do require some level of licensure. Some it's just a business license, some it's more, but you could work as a private investigator as well. And all of those have differing levels of experience required, or apprenticeship or intern time to be able to accomplish that as well. For example, my state is 2,000 hours. I'm not a licensed private investigator, but ironically enough, even though I'm not a licensed private investigator, I'm the only person in my state with about a 3-hour radius that can issue CPEs.
Okay.
So
it's
a weird thing. I spoke at their conference a few times, and a lot of the private investigators in the area, they try their boots on the ground, traditional stuff. And if they realize it's digital and they need to find somebody, usually my phone will typically ring. And there's been a couple of cases that have been very widespread, one of which the family was on Dr. Phil, that the private investigator working with the family called me and was like, hey, we don't have any budget, but we know you teach classes. Would you be willing to include this subject as the person you look for in a class? Totally. And we did that. And then we even crowdsourced it in the Discord server as well. We didn't find a whole lot. We found some stuff that was notable, and we uncovered some things that the private investigator was aware of but hadn't told me. He's like, I want you to find that out for yourself. And when we found out and I synced up with him to have a conversation, he's like, why did I even think you all wouldn't find this? Hey, the Ascension Discord has about 2,500 people just like me. An important thing to impart on someone breaking into OSIN is understand that aside from Michael Basil, there are no experts or gurus in this field. We're all students of the game. I'm just a little bit further down the line in the game, you know, a little bit higher level than some people, if you want to use the RPG mentality. You know, ultimately just stay hungry and aggressive in your pursuit of learning. Consume material from myself and from other people in the OSINT world. Try to develop your own techniques, develop your own workflows, and determine what works for you, because what works for Ray may not work for me. What works for Ghostface Killa in the chat may not work for me, and vice versa. It's one of those sides. Another question from the same person in chat is, for a beginner in OSINT, what does a daily job look like? Is it always checklist-based, like always repetitive tasks and methodologies? I'll fill this one initially. Honestly, there is no normal day. There's no such thing. You will have your defined processes, workflows, and cycles that you follow situationally. Unless you are exclusively doing reconnaissance for pen tests, unless you are exclusively doing background checks or exclusively looking for things for mergers and acquisitions, those are just some scenarios, you will probably not have a normal day. You should be ready to investigate anything. So one day you may be doing geolocation, the next day may be reverse image searching, the next day may be all about social media. You may just be doing some pen test type stuff as well. There's no normal day when it relates to OSINT. OSINT is one of those things that so many people do OSINT, but they just don't know that's what it's called. When I get with law enforcement audiences, they call it like social media investigations, digital investigations. There's so many names for it. If you look at some of the tweets and LinkedIn posts that I've made in the past, the ones that have a boatload of hashtags, those are some of the hashtags they use, like OSI or OOSI. Or open source investigations, open source information. These are all other terms. It's used widely, but I'll defer and see if Ray has anything to add with that as well.
Yeah, I think the one thing that does stand out about any type of opportunity, whether you're exploring security work like offensive security, or you're exploring defensive threat intel, whatever it is. And in this case, we are clearly focused on OSINT here. I think the big thing is to take it slowly and be careful how you approach it. what I get concerned about is like when I got into security, I had already been well warned ahead of time. Thankfully, I had some great people at Microsoft that kind of guided me down the path and made sure that I didn't stick my foot in it and break into somebody's system that I shouldn't be doing that. And this applies across the board. You, when you're doing any type of investigative work, I think you have to be careful. I think you have to be cautious. Be careful what you put your foot into. Like, I hear people talking about Tor. Oh, I'm going to go on Tor and I'm just going to start investigating stuff. And I was like, I remember speaking to a reporter, Catlin, and he's a reporter media now. And I asked him about Tor. I said, you know, I've never been on Tor and I'd like to explore. He goes, look, you have to be incredibly careful if you're going to go in some of these spaces because you don't know what's going to land on. You don't know what's going to be presented to you. You don't know who's on the other end. You end up in a dark room. Let's say somebody decides they want to spin up web, dark web, right? And they want to go on Tor and they end up in a cybercrime forum. And that just happens to be a honeypot for law enforcement. Well, guess what? Now you've been in an area where maybe you shouldn't be because you're not a professional researcher. You're not a professional security practitioner. And you have to be careful about how you approach this, especially at the beginning. You have to learn the ebbs and flows of this world and capitalize on the expertise of others who can kind of guide you down the right path of reaching into it, getting into your normal, that normal flow that you're talking about, that day-to-day flow. And basically also ensuring that you have some sense of operational security. If you start poking around in the wrong corners of the internet and the dark web, yeah, it may not be a fun experience for you. And so I would say that's one of the things that you have to be careful of. By the way, I still haven't gotten to Tor. One day I'm going to do it, but I haven't explored enough of how to do it in a safe way where I feel confident enough to go and start poking around and things. And I was watching a video that John Hammond did, for example, and he went on to, he spun up Hunix and went on Tor and went into, I think it was like a breach dump website or something like that. And that's great. I haven't done that yet, but it's because I haven't gotten to the point where I feel like, let me make sure that I'm doing this in a way that's operational and secure, where I'm not going to compromise myself and I'm not going to compromise my family. And that's really important. So I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Don't compromise yourself or the things that are important to you just for the sake of curiosity. Make sure you capitalize on that curiosity in a very safe and methodical way. Yes, don't get put on a list. Not yet.
I totally agree with that sentiment as well, because to be entirely honest, I don't have a Tor and dark web class for a reason right now. Mm-hmm. I have not found a way that I can assure that people will do so in a safe manner. Mm-hmm. And could I say, okay, you have to take this Linux hardening course and this OPSEC course first? I totally could, but I just don't feel comfortable with the liability of someone being able to say, yeah, I'm going to get on the dark web in this class. No. If you listen to the Tracelabs AMA that had Levy on it, Levy is very savvy about dark web stuff. I've talked to Levy several times about potentially collaborating on a dark web course, but there's just so many pitfalls that could be in place. I consider myself to have reasonably good OPSEC. I'm not a full acolyte of Extreme Privacy, the book written by Michael Basil, but I employ quite a few of the techniques and I will reference it from time to time as well. And my threat model is different than yours. It's almost, I don't want to say you don't have to use dark web, but I've used it in a couple of investigations, but not that many. There are enough dark web search engines mm-hmm. that are on the clear web that you can search and find if something exists, that you don't have to do it. You don't have to worry about boiling the ocean. And especially because as you're breaking into industry, you're going to be tempted to want to collect everything about everyone and keep it forever. No. You need to become a prize fighter. You have to get to a position where, is this advantageous to me? Does this further my career? Am I getting paid for this? Am I doing this out of the goodness of my heart? Why? Once you get comfortable level setting and doing it for the right experiences or the right reasons, it becomes so much easier, in my opinion. You, especially with some of the true crime stuff that took place last year, like the Gabby Petito case, I had so many people like, hey. No, I looked into it and I found so much fake news. And I hate the term fake news, but people were manufacturing intelligence so that they could try to go viral. And I was like, no, I'm going to sit over here and have an aneurysm because of this person that's making all this fake stuff to try to go viral. I'm going to have an aneurysm dealing with them. I'm not even going to be able to investigate the stuff I want to investigate. So I would provide insight, but yeah. Oh, don't even get me started about Letterkenny, Joe Best. How are you now? Huge Letterkenny fan here. Another question we've got from the chat comes from Warlord Sambo 7 as well, asking what my OSINT workstation or machine looks like. I have several. I'm a big fan of the micro ARM systems, such as this right here. This is an NVIDIA Jetson Nano. So it's a small ARM-based system with a GPU on it that I can use to crunch numbers pretty heavily if I need to. I wrote the Decepticon bot back in 2020 to run on it, but now that Twitter is charging for the API, the Decepticon bot is effectively dead. Just when I was about to rewrite it to use ChatGPT. I run TraceLabs Kali on, I believe I'm up to 3 Raspberry Pis now. I've got one I use for demonstrations, one I use for actual investigations, and one that I use to travel. I also leverage Ubuntu in the cloud. So I will just hop into, I use DigitalOcean. I'll just hop in, I'll create a cheap droplet, spin up Ubuntu, install whatever tools I need, do whatever I need to do to harden it, and then boom, off to the races again. So I do that as well. And then honestly, sometimes you need to use a Mac and a Windows system. So I operate off Mac, but I've also got some virtualization on it that allows me to run Windows as well. In addition to that, with the browsers, I use pretty much every browser that I have access to. I use user agent string checker or changers. I use location and language changers. I use virtual keyboards. If you're just starting out, I would recommend starting out with probably the TraceLabs VM. I personally don't like virtualization. It's a personal opinion thing because I always over allocate the resources for it. And then it ends up locking up my main system and I end up getting mad at it. That's why I use the Raspberry Pis, because you can get a Raspberry Pi for about $100. The limit is some software, like namely Phone Infoga, will not work on an ARM system. That's why I have the cloud as well. And then, you know, if I'm traveling and I didn't take the other Raspberry Pi, having the cloud, I can access it that way as well. I've done some tinkering with CSI Linux, but honestly, you could also, if you follow the scripts that Michael Basil provides within his book, that'll get you a very solid operating system as well. To answer your question in the most direct way possible, now that I've went the long way around the block, the most direct way is, which operating system is best for OSINT? The one that works for you. Sometimes I lead with that answer, but honestly, I think it's better if I circle back around to that answer and give you an insight into all the layers I'm going with. At the end of the day, if you're not savvy with Linux or you don't have a Mac and all you have is a Windows system, that's sufficient. Because honestly, when I'm teaching classes, more often than not, most of the demos that I run are in the browser. If I teach you a command line tool, I will teach you the browser equivalent of it. I'll also tell you the OPSEC pitfalls associated with it. Like, for example, if you're uploading images for EXIF analysis, you don't know if they're storing things. In fact, there's one website I know for a fact that stores it. It's whatever works for you. Ray, do you have anything to add there?
Not from the OSINT side. Again, OSINT's not my core strength. It's interesting. You and I just had a, we talked the other day about kind of me shoring up that. I feel like that's a little bit of a gap that I want to explore more. From the offensive security side, I just love Kali. Kali just makes things so much easier. And I know that there's folks that love PTF, the pen tester framework, which totally makes sense. And I'm a believer in what you're saying. Use what you're most comfortable with. I think when I'm doing general work around security research, Kali is great. If I'm doing an assessment, I'd like to spin up Axiom by my friend Ben Bindi, who created this framework, which spins up droplets like very easily with all these great tools. Let's see. Yes, Ubuntu and add your own tools. I actually end up using Joe's computer quite a bit. I hack into Joe Vest's computer quite often and just use his computers for my stuff. And pretty much it. That's what I like to use for most of the time. I do virtualize things because I don't know. I'm just one of those that likes to keep things separate I like to keep things separate. I like to have that level of abstraction when I'm doing things, because that way I like to know that whatever I'm running, if I'm running this hacking tool, this exploit, that it is isolated in a specific environment. That gives me kind of like a sense of solace. I know, for example, like I'm part of the Empire Project, and the guys on the Empire Project, they bust my chop because I won't run Empire on my main machine. I'm like, I'm not going to run a bare metal. Are you nuts? And they're laughing at me like, well, we run a bare metal. I'm like, you guys run a bare metal. Knock yourselves out. You know, I'm not going to run that on my machine. Hubble's Jake. He loves to run everything bare metal. I don't know. I told him he'll never connect to my network ever. He's like, his computer must be a Petri dish. I think those are I like to virtualize these platforms as much as possible. And I do run a variety of them. I do run everything from Kali to Ubuntu to, I ran Flare VM a while back. I used to have Parrot OS. And of course, I have the various Windows VMs that I use for exploit development. So I think just like you, I just use different things that are appropriate for the individual tasks. And if I need to spin up something in the cloud, I'd rather do that most of the time for an assessment, because I want to use my own resources, and then trying to go across it. The last thing I want is my own IP being banned. I'd rather just drop it into DigitalOcean or whatever and spin up something and let it go.
That abstraction, the fact that you mentioned that, in my opinion, that's paramount, because in OSINT, we always talk about having that sterile system. And that's why I use Raspberry Pis. If I didn't use Raspberry Pis, I would definitely go the virtualization route. I am thinking about upgrading my Mac. So if I do that, if everything aligns, I'll just spend $5,000 and have 96 gigs of RAM and like 19 cores. If that's the case, then I might entertain virtualization again. But with Raspberry Pi, literally what I'm able to do is I have my standard image. I burn that image to a micro SD card. I slide it into Pi. I boot it up. I do my investigation. I'm done. Cool. I power it down. I pop out the micro SD card, and then bam, I put it in my safe. When it comes time to destroy it, it gets fed to the shredder.
Yeah.
Not the one from the Ninja Turtles, but an actual literal shredder. And then I just make another copy. It's the same exact steps that you follow with regards to a VM. You have your standard image, you clone it, you run your VM, and then boom. With Kali, I like Kali a lot as well. Whenever I was doing some offensive stuff, I'm going to throw you a curveball. You want to know which operating system I actually got a lot of really good offensive use out of?
Which one?
SIFT, SANS Investigative Forensic Toolkit.
Ah, yeah.
The one they give you go to a forensics course.
Yep.
If you look back to the presentation I gave in 2019 at the Wild West Hack and Fest, Social Forensication, I think I also did that one at Hack in Paris. But basically, the concept of that whole attack is I use social engineering to convince someone that I have a legitimate need to take a memory capture of their system. Okay. I have it on a rubber ducky, and then I also have it on a thumb drive. And they have admin rights. There we go. As far as I know, SIFT is still a thing. I think it's primarily a Docker image now, Jova. I would steal the memory image. What is running in actual memory doesn't lie either.
Right.
Take that memory image. Back when I gave that presentation, we were still on volatility running on Python 2. Now we've got volatility 3, which is even more powerful. And the amount of stuff you can pull from it, using strings, you can find out network connections, you can enumerate all sorts of things. That's an example of using a defensive tool very offensively, something I'm a huge fan of as well. But the amount of times that I use that kind of stuff in offensive engagements, the pen test practice lead was like, I'm not even going to ask. Just do whatever you're going to do. I know that you don't really need a lot of the support on stuff. Here's the IP ranges. Here's the domains. Go fish whoever you want. Because when I was doing social engineering, I always hated it when the client would give me the list, because I was always afraid the client would pre-warn those people.
Right.
So I would prefer to build my own list. And then that way I could get the execs and get them really good. I would do that. And then it would be like, okay, now it's time to go do the on-site. Okay, well here, I would borrow the forensics guy's pickup truck because he had a white pickup truck. I went and I had a magnet made with the local trash company's logo on the side. So I just slapped the magnet on the side of his truck. I found one of their polo shirts at Goodwill. Yeah. So I would just stroll up with a clipboard and be like, hey, the truck driver said that there was something wrong with the arm assembly here, and I have to go inspect it. If it truly is messed up, then we're going to have to get that replaced or we're not going to be able to take your trash. We've had some problems with the driver, so I'm going to have to go take a look at it just to verify. I'm going to have to take a few pictures as well. So that way I had an excuse to have a camera out, and then I would just pull the truck up, get a few bags of trash, take back to the interns, and then, you know, we'd have a party in the parking lot. It'd always be fun with that.
By the way, this is these stories that you're sharing are what scare me about you. Okay. I'm picturing you and Joe Vest together on an assignment and wreaking total havoc. It is crazy what I'm hearing right now. And I've had great conversations with Joe. And so I'm thinking about what the two of you would do to you. Like if you two were together on something, like, oh my God, that would be wild.
That could be total chaos. Someone else create the exploits or create whatever we need, and then just let me get in and drop it. Because if you're an aspiring social engineer and you want to really do a solid baiting attack, I'll give you two of them. One, thumb drives with the word porn on them.
Yep.
Number two, this one typically works around September. Get access to an organization's break room. Find out who their insurance company is. Have posters made and put them up in the break room announcing open enrollment for insurance.
Oh my God.
Because it typically happens in October. And then just put all sorts of malice.
Oh,
if you want to watch the world burn, those are the two ways.
Joe, that's just bad.
What is it John Strand says? I light my path by the light of the bridges for which I burn.
Oh my God.
That can create some good dumpster fires for us.
By the way, I'm watching here and it says Joe's saying, I'm all talk now. Please spare me. All right. He's understating himself. I'm laughing here because I'm like, I could picture all this. Like it's just too clear for me. And as you're talking, I'm like, oh my God. Yes. Watch the world burn. That's hilarious. It'd be like a James Bond movie. It'd literally be like a James Bond movie.
Yeah. Or Mr. Robot.
True. Exactly. Mr. Robot. Oh man.
So with that assumed breach model, though, I mean, with social engineering, you can even play that into the easiest way to do the assumed breach with social engineering would probably be forwarding emails. Because some of the last phishing attacks I didn't try to send them to everyone. I never sent emails to everyone at the same time anyway. I would break it down and do it in chunks at odd intervals. What I did in the last few is I'd only send it to two or three people, and I scope these people out on social media. They're the ones that were posting things like, as of today, I declare that Facebook has no permission to use my likeness, blah, 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 you know, all of that pain letter nonsense. I would just send them something and have a call to action for them to forward it. Because if you can get someone to forward it for you, if you can get someone else to do your dirty work, yeah. I don't care if you block my email address if I can get someone to forward it for me.
Oh, Joe.
Better yet, hit them with the two-pronged attack. Have them on the phone, send them the email, and then direct them to forward it for you. And it's like, the opportunities for detection. You literally have one email out of how many that come in. I do understand that with the negative impact. That aligns with the line of conversation that I've been having lately in terms of a lot of people are saying, whenever I say, I will not target someone's personal accounts. I will surveil a personal account all day, every day. I will not try to fish or vish someone's personal phone, their personal social media, the personal email. I won't do any of that. Ultimately, I know the adversaries do that. The adversaries are adversaries. They don't play by the rules. I had a spirited discussion with someone that was like, hey, I'm going to do this. And I was like, well, you're going to step in some hot water there. I would not necessarily do it, except if the company can provide to you within the BYOD policy and an agreement signed by the employees stating that they allow that stuff to be fair game. Otherwise, I wouldn't touch it. But the adversaries do it. It's like, okay, tell me the last time you've done a red team or a pen testing engagement where DDoS or ransomware has been in scope. Full on ransomware. I'm not talking like trying to infect a machine in the test environment. I'm talking like full onset ransomware. I'll wait. And I'm sure someone probably has had that scoped. it's few and farther between. So we don't always have to play like the adversaries. We need to get as close as we can. But at the end of the day, especially with social engineering, we have to remember that these are people that we are dealing with. And right. you can't power cycle a human and make them all better again.
No,
if you go too far, you have to take those compensating steps to ensure they are in a good place before you step away.
Absolutely. I love that. I love the fact that that's the way you're thinking about it. I think all too often we forget about that human nature and that human factor, and everybody's too quick to blame, you know, and say, oh, you did this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's the thing. The presentation I gave on Wednesday at the Anti-Siphon Hackdown, the most offensive con that ever offensed, I was talking about social engineering your metrics. So it was the least technicalist talk that ever technicaled is what I called it. But I was talking about within social engineering, too many people rely on clicks and opens. And I don't really care about either because emails are meant to be opened. And sometimes the links are just that good.
Yep.
And honestly, from a security perspective, if an organization's infrastructure is so fragile that someone opening or clicking an email topples it, it's not Brenda in accounting's fault. Mm-hmm. It's the security and sysadmin team's fault.
Yep.
And too many times, and that's a rhetoric I see in social engineering where they're like, people are the biggest weakness. People are a big weakness. They're not necessarily the biggest weakness. They are a significant weakness. You can't blame individual users because it's up to the organization to spend the time to train them.
Yeah. I mean, I look at an organization like Microsoft that has gone through a whole zero trust process, and I'm not part of the effort of architecting this, but I can only imagine how this is, because it's a multi-year project. It's how long it's taken for them to architect all these different moving parts of an organization as large. And so I think about that a lot when I think about the human component, because if an organization as well funded as Microsoft or Google or Meta or any other numbers of the S&P 500 that have boatloads of money, it takes forever for them to be able to truly lock down and get into some form of zero trust. How does an SMB who is just, all they want to do is just, they might just be struggling to make ends meet. How do they secure their systems? And so I'm glad that we're talking more about the human component, because it is an important factor. There are plenty of mom and pop shops that I see. I walk into that I might walk into every single day. Just they don't know. They just want to run their business. They're selling, accessories. They're selling clothing. They're selling food, and they just want to know that they can punch in something into the cash register and it works. And here comes Joe Schmo, cyber criminal, and let's ransomware this small shop. And it's interesting, the ethics behind it. I do feel like there's, even amongst criminals, there's a growing ethical behavior. We're not going to attack people of a certain size. I'm glad at the least, because I would feel bad for that person who is a single individual that's just trying to make ends meet, and then they get their whole systems get locked, and too many of them don't know how to back up. It's hard enough for a major corporation to do it, let alone these individuals. So it is an interesting conundrum. And I know that companies like Microsoft are trying to figure out how do they work with SMBs to provide them with a better security posture. It's definitely not an easy task. Yeah, there's challenges, and it's not getting any better. I won't say that it's getting any better. And it doesn't, and I really don't.
I would say every time it gets better, to quote Rowdy Roddy Piper, when you think you know the rules, I change the game. Every time we think it's getting better, some new innovative technology or disruption occurs that completely changes everything for everyone. Always the constant game of cat and mouse.
Yeah. Think about it. We went from EXEs to doc files. Now we're at ISOs, and then ISOs, and then we have OneNote files, and all these different crazy attack chains that I look at them and I'm like, wow, what was the phrase that I was using? Jurassic Park, clever girl, for the velociraptor that would adapt to different attack styles. Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. Well, it's interesting how threat actors will adjust. They will adjust, and they're adjusting based on the information that's readily available to them. So it ties back into your world, which is OSINT. Threat actors are using OSINT. They're smart. They capitalize on everything that's out there. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually getting into a business. It's leveraging what's out there and saying, oh, we can paint a pretty good picture now of what we're going to go and how we're going to do it. So
the final thing I will say is I think that's what we get for filling in the DNA from the amber with frog DNA.
But, yes.
That being said, do you have any final parting wisdom, Ray, before I jump through the housekeeping stuff?
Yeah, sure. So I think that the one thing to keep in mind is that this industry continues to grow. There's no shortage of demand for people. It may seem that it's hard to get into the field, and that's because it is. I would say, first of all, if you're one of the gatekeepers that's preventing people with diverse perspectives from joining us, you need to stop. You need to give people a chance. Everybody out there can offer something in the security world. So if you're listening to this stream right now and you're one of those gatekeepers that thinks that for somebody to come in to this world, they need 10 years of experience with 5 certifications and they need to have these sets of tool chains experience and then you can give them an entry level SOC job. Yeah, that's gatekeeping and that's not right. We did some analysis at Microsoft.
You know who doesn't have those certifications?
Who? You?
The adversaries.
That's right. Exactly. I have 2 certs and the rest has just been me putting in the work, tenacity, trying to understand, having conversations with senior leaders like yourself, with folks like Joe Vest, and spending time and trying to understand how threat actors think. Give these people a chance. There's so many talented people, and especially the young ones, the up and comers who you can see are vested. They want to defend people. They want to provide security solutions, and they're being blocked because somebody has this perception that if you don't have all these certifications, you're just not good enough. That shouldn't be the case. I was grateful when I started in 1989 that somebody gave me a chance. They said, hey, you know, you haven't been programming. I said, look, I'll work for $6 an hour. Just give me a chance. Let me show you. And he took a chance on me and he hired me and he paid me $7 an hour. And I bet you there's a lot of people that are in similar situations. They just want a chance. They want that opportunity to get their foot in the door and show that they're willing to take what they've learned, apply it to the real world and adapt to the things that are happening based on how you mentor them. Bring them along. This is a journey. This is not just something that has to happen immediately.
That's exactly it. Similar story. I broke into this industry in 2010 as I was getting out of the Navy because someone, a friend of a friend from the Navy, was hiring for an entry-level GRC type position. Here we are 13 years later, and they are now mentioned in the acknowledgments of the book.
Awesome.
So
awesome.
Join us on next Tuesday. I will have Brent White and Tim Roberts on from WeHackPeople.com to talk more OSINT, social engineering, and red teaming stuff. But with that being said, thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
If you are interested in on-demand training, check out the Ascension Academy. We currently have 3 courses available. You can bundle all 3 of those courses or 2 of those courses. We have replays of webinars as well as a lot of free content. Visit academy.theascension.com. If you're interested in purchasing courses from the Ascension, you can do so in a variety of ways. The easiest way is the Ascension store, which is at theascension.com/courses/store. You can purchase bundles, individual courses, and placeholders here. If you would like a custom bundle, please email bundles@theascension.com for custom bundles or questions. If you'd like to bundle these courses, we offer this in a payment plan and as a one-time payment. There are the links to take care of that. You can follow us on Twitch. osint.mobi/twitch is the redirect. osint.mobi/YouTube is the YouTube redirect. And also, we maintain a couple of communities. On Discord, we maintain the Ascension Discord, which is osint.mobi/Discord. And we are also members of OSINTelligence on LinkedIn, which you can join via osint.mobi/OSINTelligence. There are the links to my social media as well as the Ascension's. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like this video, comment, share, subscribe, and hit that notification bell.